You're listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion with Taina Asili. Martha Redbone is a Native and African-American vocalist, songwriter, composer, and educator. She's known for her unique gumbo of folk, blues, and gospel from her childhood in Harlan County, Kentucky, infused with the electric grit of pre-gentrified Brooklyn. Inheriting the powerful vocal range of her gospel-singing African-American father and the resilient spirit of her mother's Cherokee Choctaw culture, Martha broadens the boundaries of American roots music. With songs and storytelling that share her life experience as an Afro-Indigenous woman and mother navigating in the new millennium, she gives voice to issues of social justice, bridging traditions, connecting cultures, and celebrating the human spirit. I first met Martha when her and I joined our beloved friend Toshi Regan for a special performance Toshi brought together at Carnegie Hall entitled Soul Mechanism. That day, I knew we would become friends for a long time to come. Most recently, Martha and I performed together at another special event entitled Action Songs, Protest Dances, produced by choreographer Edissa Weeks at the Kupferberg Center for the Arts at Queens College. It is a huge honor to have Martha Redbone on the show today. Hello, Martha. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I'm so grateful to have you. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much, Taina. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, so it's so nice to connect on here and dig in deeper and, you know.
I'm so grateful. I know that we had intended to do this as like a backstage interview, so we were together at Queens College for a performance at the Kupferberg Performing Arts Center, working with choreographer Edissa Weeks and Delirious Dances in a project centered on the teachings of James Forman. And Martha and I were hired composers and performers on this project. And we once again had the opportunity to share a stage and a backstage.
And we got to be in this space with Spirit McIntyre as well, which was so awesome too.
Oh, and the three of us together, it was like so perfection. So grateful for that moment. And I'm also grateful for that moment because it brought us all together using the skills that we have as composers who work to create music that creates positive change in our world, you know, that contributes to social justice, to healing, you know, on this earth. And each of us coming with a different perspective, an approach, and a voice, and an expression of that craft and what it means. And so I was so grateful to see how each of us took this subject matter and how we interpreted it in our own unique voices. And I was feeling really impacted by it. You wrote a song called Gold for that piece, which I continued to sing long after that day. And I felt really changed by that. I felt really changed by, you know, I heard those lyrics and they resonate in, you know, you carry that with you. When you get like an inspiration, you carry that with you and you're like, teachings start to unfold as you go along.
Yes.
And I was thinking back to my earliest memory of being impacted by music. I remember singing Whitney Houston's The Greatest Love of All as a child. And not really maybe even fully understanding all the messages and teachings that were in it, but feeling really impacted by that. And I was curious about one of your early childhood memories in terms of music impacting or changing you in some way.
Wow. Well, I have two that really resonated for different reasons and at different times. I'll start with the most profound one because it has really subconsciously defined everything that I am today, you know, so it's interesting. So I was raised by my grandparents in Kentucky until I went to middle school. And so moved back to Brooklyn just before I turned 12 years old, 11, 11, sixth grade. Well, when I first left Brooklyn, my parents were together. When I came back to Brooklyn, I came back to a single parent household. And the only thing left of my dad was this big console, stereo console, and a bunch of records. Tons and tons of records, 45s and LPs and a piano. We had an upright piano. And so I remember playing, some of these old records, and I have them right over here still, quite a few of them. And I remember, just putting on the different records and dancing and doing silly dances. And at that time, like I said, my mom was, going through separated and she was, like battling depression and like, pissed off, because my dad went off with someone else, So I found myself like trying to do things like be silly to like cheer her up and stuff, So I'm like doing all the kind of like Soul Train dances and all this kind of stuff. And I remember putting on the James Brown record, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And so I remember, dancing around to that. Say it loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Do, 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 right? And at the end of that, my mom said, is that all you're proud to be? She said, don't I count for something?
Wow.
And I remember being like 11, and kind of like, I didn't know what that was. I thought she was laughing, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm in trouble. I've done something wrong. I know I did something to upset her, but I wasn't sure what it was. And so she said, she goes, you're only proud to be black. She said, you should also be proud to be Indian. She's old school, so she used the word Indian. She goes, you should also be just as proud to be Indian as you are black. And she said, do not erase us.
Wow.
And that I remember, I didn't really understand what she meant at that time. Don't participate in the genocide of your own people. That was the phrase,
Wow.
Don't participate in the genocide of your own people. Do not erase us. You should be just as proud to be Indian as you are black. And I thought, okay, And I didn't realize at that time what an impact those words would have on the rest of my life. I had no idea. And, as a black community and as descendants of indigenous people, and because of the lay of this land, we're forced to choose, defined by whatever government regulations and legislations they put in place. Sometimes there are some times where you'll be called mulatto, you'll be called colored, you'll be called black, you'll be called whatever, all of these different terms. Are you biracial or are you African? But if you're African, are you African from Africa? Are you African American? Are you Afro-Caribbean? Are you Afro-Latina? Are you this? And it's like, why do people keep trying to just divide us up, cut us up into these little pieces of, takeout pizza, And then, when you're in the street, walking down the street, how are you described by other people too? Different ways. So I'm going deep because that's that song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. That was James Brown taking ownership, of who we are, as black people and the black community and all of the things that the black community can build and develop on our own. And that ownership and that leadership is important. It's important in every ethnic community, you know? And so when I think about erasure, and when I think about all of our roles in our own erasure, you know, my mom raised me, my maternal grandparents raised me. And, you know, my parents split up the first time I was 3 years old, and the second time I was 7 years old, you know. And I didn't really know my dad's family well until I became an adult. You know, I'd see them like maybe once or twice, you know, a few times when I'm maybe really little, too little to remember. But after that, it wasn't until I'm an adult, you know, and I can understand my mother seeing, you're giving all the credit to him. You know, you're giving all this credit to them, and I'm here. I'm doing this work.
Right.
I'm, you know, working two jobs. I'm paying the rent. I'm paying the bill. And you're not even claiming me or any part of where I come from at all. Mm. All that to say is when I think about our own role in our own erasure, because it's what we've been taught. We've been taught that we don't matter. And we've been taught that we have the ability to erase ourselves.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's our choice.
Right.
To kill ourselves off. That we made it happen. You guys did it. You know? And to me, that is the epitome of the evil of colonization that there is, where you're at the point where you can convince the oppressed to kill off themselves.
Right. Exactly.
And so just from that song, that Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and being told by my mother, you know, who is Afro-Indigenous, you know, herself, who is a Southeastern Cherokee Choctaw and Black woman, you know, for her to say, don't erase us. And don't participate in the genocide of your own people. And I had no idea how that was going to play such a profound part of my life, like in my career.
Yeah.
You know, so basically since then, I feel like I've been doing everything I can to make sure that my story is included in this American narrative.
Wow.
And it's my responsibility to encourage others to do the same, because we're all making contributions to this land.
That's right.
And we all have a role in the cycle of harmony and working towards continuing to have that, because it's been broken up so much. And, you know, Mother Earth is in a bad way, you know? And so it's important for us, each individual, to tell our story. You know, people love to talk about the story of America and this being this melting pot and all of this kind of, you know, the stuff that people talk about. But the reality is, as part of this melting pot is being allowed for each individual to add their spice into the stew. And we have not all been allowed to put our spice in.
Right.
So if we're going to be this melting pot, then let the millions and millions of people here add their spice into the stew, and let's raise it up and show the reason why this tastes like this is because these guys put this here. And this is why, oh, you love that cinnamon flavor? Well, that comes from this. Oh, you love that garlic? Right. That comes from this.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
We have to take ownership and telling our own stories, each individual story. And I strongly, strongly believe that that is the key to ending this thing called racism. Because this racism, race doesn't exist. These are categories that the oppressors made.
Right.
And are trying to squeeze us into these boxes.
Absolutely.
And the individual story is important. Individual family story is super important and more than we realize. And the reason why we know how important it is by how much people go out of their way to try to silence us.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
You know?
That's it.
So the gatekeepers of all of it, who gets to say you're Black? Who gets to say you're Indigenous? Who gets to say you're Asian? Who gets to say you're whatever, you know? Who gets to say you're white? The business of being white. Who gets to say you're white? Or are you Irish or Italian or Scottish or German or French or what, you know? Who gets to say this? And so these things are policed, you know? And so I know it's important because people go out of their way to try to silence it or to say it doesn't matter or that they don't see color.
I love that you use the metaphor of the spice because I talk about my song Sofrito, which is like
this special sauce that we use
in our cooking.
That's right. I love that. I sang Sofrito with you.
Oh, that's right. And, you know, this potent mixture of powerful ingredients. And, you know, my mother was also someone who wanted to constantly remind me and my sister of who we are and where we come from. She did so through our names, right? My name being Taina.
That's right.
To represent our Taino heritage, and my sister's being Ayana to represent our African heritage. Mm-hmm. And to always remember, you know, she put it into our names because we can never forget. Right. And I also had no idea how that was going to shape my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And to be honest, for so much of my life, I had shame about my name.
Wow. Yeah. Me too.
You know, when we're rubbing up against the dominant narratives of society and trying to figure out how do we fit in. But it was that gift of the name and then my mother's constant reminder of why she gave us these names that allowed me to refocus, you know, especially as I grew into myself as an artist. And that sofrito, you know, I love to open a set with the sofrito because it's like, it's that reminder of who we are and where we come from that's necessary to help us understand where we need to go next, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a conjuring of the spirits and of the elements. Yeah.
Exactly. So what is this other story?
I think I might have been in like the third grade or something like that and seeing Chaka Khan, Rufus and Chaka Khan on Soul Train. And I remember how free and happy and beautiful she was and her singing. And I remember seeing the band play, you know, and she had all the feathers and the fringe and, you know, and her hair was, you know, just like wild. And I remember that feeling of this freedom, you know, to me, she represented this woman being completely free, you know. And my mother, who was my kind of role figure, you know, kind of like role model, was very conservative. You know, very conservative. So, you know, the hair was always, you know, straight and, you know, kind of like straightened out and, you know, curled to perfection, you know, just like, you know, and she was very conservative with how she dressed. She didn't show a lot of skin. Very conservative, you know.
Right.
Her views were not conservative, but how she carried herself was conservative. And then to see someone like Chaka Khan, who was this young woman who was just like wild and free, you know, seeing that, I got to see this, you know, this other side of what it means to be a woman, you know, and completely owning who you are. You know, and the teenagers in our family, you know, they were all like wore cool clothes and had that kind of spirit, you know. Whereas my mother, who came from more conservative, you know, humble means, was much more into kind of doing the right thing and just trying not to be noticed, try to, you know, be like an upstanding citizen in the, you know, in the community, you know, like trying to do all the things that the stereotypes said that Indigenous people or people of color were, you know, we're lazy, we're stupid, we're this, we're all these different things. So in her mindset, I guess with the way that she came up, was to show people that we are articulate, that we are well read, that we are, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, like this kind of stuff. That was her thing, try not to fit into the stereotypes that they've created for us. Right. So she became more rigid on that. And then when you look at someone like Chaka Khan on Soul Train, you know, with her bikini top with the feathers and the, you know, and she's just, ah! You know, and it's like, Chaka Khan is like, fuck all that. You right. know what I mean? She's right. like, fuck all that. This is me. Like me That's as right. I am. Kiss my ass, you know?
Thank you.
And right. that was, to me, it just showed like the difference in the generations. And I felt very inspired by that. I felt very inspired by that. I thought, well, you know, here's two beautiful women, my mom and then this younger, you know, little spitfire, you know, and these are all the, I could be the full spectrum.
Yes.
You know, you can own it all. There's many ways to be a beautiful woman of color. You know, mm-hmm. there's many ways to own it all. And mm-hmm. so I remember, you know, being, you know, probably like 7 years old or 8 years old and like just having my mind blown by the freedom that she had. She, to me, Chaka Khan, just in her name in itself, and just she represented freedom. Just yeah. free spirit, a free spirit. And, you know, that voice, it just like just soaring through the heights, you know. Mm-hmm. Aretha Franklin had that too, who was, you know, clearly like an influence. But I felt like Chaka Khan took it like a step even further into, wow. you know, like into the stratosphere, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember that being... something that I wanted to be. I wanted to have that kind of energy as a woman. It was like showing me what it was like to be this kind of spectrum of what it means to be a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, thinking about who you are now mm. as a woman, you know, I know for myself, you know, in terms of my process of liberation, one of the things that I have found interesting is that not only am I inspired by the voices, the Whitney Houstons and the Chaka Khans and the Aretha Franklins and the James Browns and, you know, the Celia Cruzes that we were raised in, but that there is a divine within me that speaks through my own creative work that is teaching me.
That's right.
And I'm curious about what that has looked like for you. You know, is there a time where you have felt like your work was a powerful teaching moment? Maybe you wrote a song and you're like, wow, I didn't even know I had that within me. Or there was like a lesson that you didn't realize was there. Or maybe you shared a song and there was something new that you learned from it that was different from the original intention of the song that you're like, oh, actually, I think this means... Yeah. This. Have you had any of those moments, those teaching moments?
Yeah, all the time. I have those teaching moments all the time. And I'll tell you why I think I have them all the time. You know, when I started out in this music business, you know, as a songwriter and, you know, my partner, you know, Aaron and I were writers with Warner Chappell Music for many years, for almost 20 years. And, what I realized was when you're hired to write kind of pop songs, you know, for the music business, you're writing things that go from either timeless classics that you're aiming for, or you're writing with the mode of the time, you know, with whatever came out last week, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're still always trying to be innovative and put your own kind of unique twist on thing sets so that you stand out, you know, so that you can place your songs, right, with the artists. But at the end of the day, you're trying to create a sound and a style for whatever artist that is being sent you. And that is its own kind of, like I said, whatever the mode of the time is, you know, right. Like if I use, for example, say like Taylor Swift, and then you look at Lizzo, you know, and then you look at like a Lady Gaga, you know. So these are three superstars, and the music has certain elements, you know. Lizzo means hip hop, kind of trap beats, different, you know, kind of stuff. You know, Taylor Swift is like highly polished pop meets country. You know, Lady Gaga is like dance music, you know, nightclub music plus, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And timeless classics mixed in with this kind of thing, you know, and Adele as well. You can kind of look at those different styles. And so what I realized for myself as an artist trying to have my own style, I didn't have a template because none of those templates reflected who I was.
Right.
And so I'm coming up with a sound that is completely unique to the music that I heard growing up, the culture that I have growing up, and the stories that I write are different as well. And so when you're doing something that no one has heard before, no one can measure it, compare it to other things. So the, you know, people in the industry is like, well, I mean, what does this sound like? I mean, do you sound like, you know, but when you go to someone like Lizzo, you know, Lizzo sounds like just a step up from the person who came before them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I'm not negating her music. I mean, she's brilliant and talented and can sing and rap and do the whole, you know what I mean? She has it all. But I'm saying that, you know, Gwen Stefani was one of the original templates of that, you know, and the sounds that have developed, that have come from that, there's an origin, you know, there's an origin there, you know, but the origin of the music that I'm doing is not an origin that is part of the mainstream.
Right.
You know, so when you don't have that example to say, oh, this sounds like whatever, then I remember being told, oh, he's going to be kind of like Sheryl Crow or kind of like this and that. And it's like, no, you know, that's not it, you know. And so when you don't have the kind of template where the box for people to fit you in,
right,
you're left doubting yourself.
Right.
You know, and so you can either choose two roads to which to go. You can join these people who get paid a lot of money to come up with all these different names and try to fit into their box. And if they say you don't fit into the box, you can feel bad about it, you know, and change yourself to fit into their box. Or you can own what you do because it's what you hear and it's who you are. And you own that. You own it and you keep doing it and you build your community. And that's how I made that decision to become a grassroots artist, because I'm not trying to sound like anybody else, you know. Trying to sound like anybody else.
Right.
I'm done, because right. If you try to sound like anybody else, you know, if somebody says, oh my God, you sound just like Whitney Houston, but you're not Whitney Houston.
Right.
So why do I need to make my music exactly like Whitney Houston? People buy her records.
Right.
You know what I mean? She's already been proven. So why am I going to buy yet a new Whitney Houston? It's like, what's the point of that? I need to sound like me, mm-hmm. you know? And so I ended up ignoring all that bullshit and owning my sound and owning my story. And I realized that being an artist was a lot deeper than fighting to be in the Billboard top 10, you know? that's only a part of the story.
Right.
You know, and it's so short-lived. That's part of the story is so short-lived. And it's interesting. Like I see myself as a musician, you know, I'm a singer, songwriter, musician, composer, you know, I have a career, you know, and I've been singing for a really long time and I'm gonna sing for a really long time. And there's no cap to what I do, you know, because my journey was not based on, you know, how much cleavage I'm going to put in this music video and what I'm going to squeeze myself into this corset and I'm going to, you know what I mean? And what hair weave or whatever I'm going to put on to, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I don't have that pressure.
Right.
Because I'm choosing not to have that kind of pressure. You know, the pressure that I'm giving myself as an artist is making sure that I stay true to my story. And as I age, to own it gracefully and to honor it because I earned it. Yes. I earned it. And I'm still in the story and I'm still telling the story because I'm still in it.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So that's kind of how I look at trying to make a style that, you know, no one's ever heard of or this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's because no one hasn't heard of it. And I'm not trying to make it match something else. It's just the sound that comes out.
Right.
You know, and I'm answering the call. I'm answering the call. You know?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It makes me think about, you know, I do workshops with young people around music and social change. And we talk about different approaches to writing a social justice song. You know, sometimes when people think of a song for social change, they might just think of like a protest song or a protest anthem.
Right.
And that is one approach to songwriting.
That's part of it.
But I also think there are a lot of different elements and different perspectives. And, you know, some of what I hear in your music is some of what we talked about earlier, which is that reclamation of culture and history, and that being, you know, that reclamation that moves through oppression, that moves through colonialism and forced migration and enslavement and brings us into this present moment. Mm-hmm. And the other piece, which I think is also that you just articulated, that's also much more difficult than we give it credit, is speaking our authentic truth to power, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that that alone is a powerful social justice act, mm-hmm. you know? And you do that so beautifully. Do you see your work as connected to social change?
Absolutely. I think that by default, by birth, we are social justice. We are political figures by birth. As soon as you are, you know, a black and brown person born, you know, in this country, which was, you know, based off of colonization and Jim Crow, and we're here today able to make music for a living, not cleaning people's houses. You know, because that's certainly where I came from, you know, and for our journey to be able to have the life that we have today because of what our ancestors struggled and suffered and toiled and everything in order for us to be here, you know, like cleaning houses and, you know, taking care of other people's kids and all of the stories that we have, you know, farming and gardening and sewing and whatever it is. Our existence is an act of protest.
Yes.
We are alive. We are political figures. We are living, breathing political figures. All of us.
Each breath is a form of resistance.
All of us. Yes. All of us. How can we not see that? and feel that when every time we leave the house or every time we open a newspaper or read an article, we are faced with people trying to tell us that we're less than. Mm. On a daily basis. I don't know if there's a single day that I am alive and that I leave this house or turn on the television or turn on the radio or read something in social media that does not show some form of emotional and psychological abuse that is building towards the erasure of my people.
Right, right.
There isn't a single day. There isn't a single day that passes that I am not reminded that I am less than.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about it and literally every single day. I mean, just yesterday, I had to get boots. I don't have boots for the winter. So I went into the mall here. And just a little thing where you're standing in line waiting with your stuff. And a white woman just walks right in front of you and just puts her stuff on the counter. I just want to ask a question. And they answer her question. And then she stands there and then puts it on the counter like that. Like, oh, and since I'm here, you can just check me out. And I've been standing there.
Wow.
This kind of thing happens literally every day. It's just the microaggressions. I don't call them microaggressions. They call them microaggressions. It's not micro. It's fucking macro aggressions. Mm. This is a real statement of that you do not exist. Or if it's not that you do not exist, it is that you are not important as me. And what I have is more pressing. You have to know that what I have is more important and much more urgency than anything that you have because you're just standing there. But what I have is much more pressing. So this is what I deal with all the time on a daily basis. Right. So when I think of us as, you know, pillars of social justice, we are just by existing and by sharing our stories.
Right.
We just are.
Right.
And which is also why people want to silence us.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So. Right.
And why it can be so difficult to find places to share those stories.
Yeah.
As grassroots artists, how it can be difficult sometimes.
Yes.
You have a couple of new places that you're going to be sharing your work coming up, and they sound super interesting, super powerful. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about them.
We are, when I say we, I always talk about my partner, Aaron Whitby, my longtime collaborator and husband.
Shout out to Aaron.
Shout out to Aaron Whitby. we are developing a piece at the Public Theater called Black Mountain Women. And Les Waters is our director. And we took a pause, you know, because of COVID and everything. But I'm looking forward to getting back into that. I want to write stories about my homeland. So I am writing about Black Mountain. I'm writing Kentucky stories because I think it's important that people understand where, you know, that's, it's not only just Kentucky, it's my ancestral homeland. And also, you know, Kentucky and Black Mountain was the original Cherokee Shawnee territory before a removal, before the Trail of Tears. And so, first of all, the land is absolutely beautiful. Mm. And when you explore, there are these incredible caves that, you know, they call us the cave dwellers. You know, and there's these amazing caves there. You know, this is pre-contact where you would go in harsh weather, and they're huge. You go in and they're absolutely enormous. And there are some places now there who actually have give concerts. They give folk and bluegrass and blues concerts inside these caves there. And so just digging deeper and exploring the land itself, and as things continue to change around and threaten our existence in those mountains, you know, with strip mining and mountaintop removal and water contamination and a lot of things that are threatening our lives and our families there, and with all of the environmental conflicts that are happening, we are under threat of yet another forced removal.
Right.
And, you know, what does that mean to, you know, the indigenous people of that area? What does that mean? And how do we handle that? And so those are the things that we're looking at and going to explore in this particular musical theater piece. Mm. And another piece that I'm doing is I've just become a new cohort with the Apollo Theater's New Works department. And so I'll be working on a piece there, which I can't speak on yet. So that one's top secret. So I have to get.
Okay.
But as soon as I'm given the okay with that, I'm really excited to be a part of the cohort this year, the Apollo Theater. If my mom were here today, if she were alive today, she would be just thrilled to know that we'll be making a piece of music and theater and one of the most prestigious Black institutions in the country. It's such an honor to be a part of it. I can't even describe the thrills that I have from that.
Wow. Yeah. That's so magical. One of my favorite stories of my father was when he performed at the Apollo Theater as a teen.
Oh, wow.
Remembering that he was so excited that he didn't get booed off the stage. He had a doo-wop group. And, you know, I have so many fond memories of different moments throughout the years at the Apollo. So I'm so grateful that your voice, your work will be gracing that stage.
I'm excited. I'm really excited. I'm really thrilled. I can't tell you. I'm so excited about what's to come from that. I just think it's a good time, you know, and coming through this pandemic and all that we've, you know, that we've lost, you know, and all that we've been, I feel really grateful to still be able to to do this, you know what I mean? Yes. To create music. I mean, it's like it's really an interesting time. It's a frightening time, you know, to be an artist. It's a really scary time to be an independent artist. And I feel like every single thing that happens is this huge blessing to, I guess, like for me, it's almost like I feel like you know, these ancestors are kind of like standing, like here's my James Baldwin, you know, I feel like they're saying, we got you, just keep going forward, you know, don't look back. Absolutely. You know, you're not going that way, you're going forward. And so that's kind of how I'm treating it. I'm just, all right, I'm just going forward.
Well, I'm so grateful to you, Martha, as an artist. You know, sometimes we need some people to kind of take us by the elbow and carry us a little bit when we're feeling a moment of, you know, deep grief or difficulty. And, you know, you and so many other beautiful artists in my life are the people that, you know, help to keep me going, inspire me. And, you know, I am so grateful. I feel your ancestors. I feel them. I give thanks to them, too. And I pray that our ancestors are up there dancing, enjoying one another. And
thank you so much, Taina. And I'm really grateful for you, too. I mean, you and Gaetano are just a huge inspiration for Aaron and me as well. And your leadership, you know, your sense of community and all the seeds that you are literally planting, you are literally planting, are just really, you know, when you look at people and you say, yeah, this person really knows, she, you know, there's this connection, she's at one with the earth, You know, you are of the earth, and everything that you do is breathing life in. And I don't know, like, it's an interesting thing. You know how you see people's aura, you know, and you see things when you talk to people and you see their light and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. But like for me, like what I see in whenever I see you, Tiny, I see all these leaves. I see like all these like little beautiful, like as if you're this tree with these tiny little leaves, you know, like kind of sprouting, you know, and just like growing, you know. That's what I see.
Thank you.
You know, it's
I'm
like
so, I'm so this, humbled.
It's
so
like
honored.
You're like this living being of like, I don't know, like these vines and kind of just these leaves. You know what I mean?
Thank you, Martha.
We should do an album cover as a photo shoot. You know, do a
we
photo
should.
Shoot with something like we that. Should. But that's yes. what I see. It's like it's like you're this living, breathing. You know, it's like. It's like it's something I can't really describe. It's your connection to the earth that I have not seen, and I've only seen in one other person, you know, but you have that, which and that's a really that to me that's like something that you know I would love to have, you know, but you but that's like it's so great to see to me, like just seeing it really inspires me.
Thank you. That you don't even know. I'm like, what do I say? I'm like so humble,
you don't have to
so
say
grateful,
anything.
So honored. And I receive it with deep, deep, deep gratitude. Deep, deep gratitude for you. I'm wishing you all the best in all this new creative work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
I cannot wait to witness it. And,
oh, thank you.
Continue to be in love with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion. I want to thank our guests today, as well as Moses Nagel, our editor, Sina Basila Hickey, and all of our partners at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. You can find me on Facebook at Taina Asili Music, on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at Taina Asili, and at TainaAsili.com. Peace, love, and liberation.